This is Julian Valdivia with the Sam Proctor Oral History Program. I'm sitting here today in the Roberto Clemente Park at the Lee County Black History Society, and today I'll be interviewing
Lovey Wells Jr.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Wells, for being here today.
Okay.
The first thing I want to ask is, when and where were you born?
I was born in Fort Myers, Florida.
Okay.
When and where? When? It was in 1952. November
right.
the 10th, 1952.
Okay. So, looking at that date then, hold on, I'm trying to do the math in my head. Remember, I'm a history major, not a math major.
65 years ago.
Yeah, so, but looking at it, so you were kind of part of the group that, well, when you were graduating, that were you in Dunbar High School when they closed it?
I went, the year Dunbar High School was closed was the year that my senior class was dispersed among the three other high schools here. I ended up graduating from Fort Myers Senior High School.
Oh, okay.
There was North Fort Myers and there was Cypress Lake.
Mm.
So all of the students that attended Dunbar basically were divvied up between those three schools.
Yeah. Okay, but I'm getting ahead of myself. I just saw that and I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. Most people I've interviewed so far have been from, like, born in, like, the 30s or the 40s, so they weren't, like, part of that graduating class, and I was like, oh, wow.
Okay.
But it'll be cool. I'll have questions. First, I just want to ask you about your early life growing up. Who were your parents, and how many siblings did you have?
I have two brothers and one sister.
Okay.
And myself and my sister, I'm the oldest of four.
Mm.
My sister's 2 years younger than I am. My parents were teachers.
Okay.
My dad was a teacher here in Lee County from 1960 to when he retired in 1994. My mother was also a teacher in Lee County, and she retired as a school psychologist in 1994. Mm. So I'm as they say, I'm a TK. I'm a teacher's kid.
I'm kind of getting ahead in the interview, but were your parents kind of the inspiration for you to become a teacher later on then?
Well, actually, teaching was not. I ended up becoming a teacher, but when I matriculated through college, that was the last thing I wanted to do, teach school, because I got my degree in political science.
Okay.
At which time I was thinking about going to law school, but I ended up getting married, so I had to think about going to work. And I ended up going to work. I worked in state and local government for, probably 19 years.
Okay.
19 years. I worked for the state of Louisiana for two and a half years, and then I moved back home to Fort Myers, Florida, and I worked for the state of Florida for 2.5 years, and then I worked for the county for 13 years, and I spent the last of my career in academia working for the school district. I put in 19 years. I was only going to do 15.
Mm.
They convinced me to stay an extra 5. They couldn't convince me to stay any more, though. So I've had a rather varied career.
Yeah. Okay. So then I want to ask still more like about you growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Myers at the time obviously was segregated along
sure.
the train tracks and things like that. How did your parents explain segregation to you as a child?
Well, actually, growing up in segregation, nobody had to really explain it.
Mm.
I mean, it just was.
Yeah.
It was interesting because, you know, being a child from parents who were teachers, obviously I'm considered one of the more fortunate ones because the teachers were, you know, when you look in the black community, they were much more, held in much higher esteem probably than today, because oftentimes if you were educated black, you either taught, you either were the funeral home director,
mm.
or you were a preacher. Okay? I mean, those, because, and the reason I say that is my dad was in the service, and when he came out of the service in 1960, he was trained in guided missiles. Mm. Now, needless to say, he did not know that he was on the cutting edge of a new science. Because of the color line, he could not get a job at Cape Canaveral.
Oh, wow.
Even though he was a master sergeant trained in guided missiles by the U.S. Army, he couldn't really get a job in his field. Mm. And he decided he did not want a career in the military because, of course, he would have had a stellar career because, you know, he's just a brilliant guy.
Yeah.
He decided to teach as opposed to go to medical school because his mother was a midwife in this community.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, growing up, I had a pretty, you know, I won't say sheltered life, but I had a good time. I was just a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember playing with the neighborhood kids, going to school. You know, you have your little, about back then, if you had a little fisticuff, you had it, boom, it was over with. Next day, you're playing with the same people because it was a small community.
Yeah.
I think Lee County back then maybe had 50,000 people, if that many.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my grandmother, being a midwife, delivered most of the children.
Mm.
Matter of fact, she's in the Hall of Fame for black family, black females in Florida, because one year she delivered, they say, 5,000 babies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's a workaholic.
Mm.
I have this joke. I tell people, if she got paid for half of them, I never would have had to work a day in my life. But back in the day, I mean, a delivery, $50 or something like that, which was big, nice money, but a lot of times she was just a kind-hearted person, and, you know, if you needed help, she'd give you help.
Mm.
My dad and my mom were both first-generation college graduates.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yes, from both of their families. They went to a private high school called Fesden in Central Florida.
Mm.
And from Fesden, they went to Dillard University, which is a premier school in New Orleans, and decided to come back to Florida. So, you know, as a kid, hey, I had a typical kid's thing. Now, one thing, though, about segregation, I'll say, it was unusual to see whites in the neighborhood.
Okay.
My grandmother actually ran a nursery, and the only whites I remember seeing in the neighborhood were either insurance people or the guy that would bring the cookies around to service her nursery there. I mean, but you didn't see other whites.
Okay.
Only if you went downtown, you saw. But if you came in Dunbar, no whites out here.
Yeah.
You go to school, no whites at my school, because I went to Dunbar High School, which was segregated. All black teachers, all black students. Matter of fact, it was when integration did occur my senior year, it was like us beating a whole group of folks that we didn't even know existed.
Mm.
I mean, people say, well, why don't you go to your senior class? I say, well, you need to understand, we really don't know each other.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't. I was an athlete, so I was considered one of the popular people. But the bottom line is, I didn't know those other people. I grew up with other people here from elementary school, but the other people I didn't know, so I don't pay much attention to high school reunions at the high school that I graduated from.
Mm.
And I think really looking at my career, being able to teach at the high school that I spent most of my time at was a crowning. It was a crowning glory for me. Really, I really enjoyed it, every moment out there.
Mm, that's good to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I really did. I went full circle.
Mm. Since like you were in school at the time, because I want to ask about you,
sure,
like your experience in school. I know in, because I've been like reading a lot of the old news press papers, and I saw in 1964 that the Lee County School Board came up with a desegregation plan.
Yes.
But they said it was never implemented, and I asked, do you know George Mayo?
Oh, yeah.
I had asked George Mayo about it, and he said that, like, the whole idea was integrating teaching staff at first.
Yes. They had something they called, they had this plan. It's interesting because I did a paper on it, but some of it's hazy. What I found was that following the 1954 Brown versus Education decisions, mm-hmm. this county took until 1964 to do some kind of desegregation plan that basically said that, look, if you wanted to go to a integrated school, we'll start in the first grade and work our way up.
Okay.
Each year we'd add another grade.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening, I believe, in 1968 or 69, people began to look at that plan and whether or not it was, in fact, integrating communities or integrating student populations, and came to the conclusion that it was.
Okay.
And I don't know what the precipitate force was, but because Dunbar High School on Edison Avenue was a brand new school.
Mm-hmm.
When it was closed down.
Yeah.
Which financially makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
You know, it made no sense. And what they did was in 1970, which was my graduating year, they basically took the student population at Dunbar High School and split it up amongst the junior high schools and high schools there. Because keep in mind, back then there were no middle schools.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, junior high school was grades 7 through 9, I want to say. And high school was 10 through 12.
Okay.
And elementary school was actually 1 through 6. So what would happen is my sister, who was a freshman or sophomore, I believe, ended up going to Fort Myers Middle School. Well, and that's called middle school, but it was Fort Myers Junior High School then.
Yeah.
And ended up, and I ended up going to Fort Myers High School for 1 year. I went 2 years because I went the last year of what they call freedom of choice. And I went out of curiosity, really.
Mm.
In retrospect, I should have stayed at Dunbar High School until they closed it. And I was talking with a classmate of mine the other day, and a classmate of mine was saying that he recalls during that time instructors telling us that we ought to probably go to summer school so we could finish early, which would have meant that we would have graduated from Dunbar High School.
Yeah.
And not have to deal with this whole transitional thing where they split the classes up.
Mm.
I told him I never really thought of that as an idea, because back in the day, shoot, we're like most kids, man. When school was out, you didn't have to make up no credits and stuff. You want to relax. You know, now what we would do, though, is that we would get a part-time job somewhere.
Okay.
During the summertime, and then come back to school and, you know, finish out and this kind of thing. But it was a trying, traumatic time, really, for a lot of people. I think of myself as one who was gifted at that time, having parents who were educators, and really not having a difficult time at doing the study part. I was a decent athlete, which meant, you know, popularity-wise, I mean, even though I was a teacher's kid, I wasn't disdained, and nobody come up want to spit at me and stuff.
Yeah.
But when we went to the white schools, that was tough, okay? That year was really tough because you ended up finding out that some of the instructional material that you had was second rate.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the classes you were placed in, people had previous educational experiences that you didn't have, so there's a little bit of catch up there.
Yeah.
And you found that, you know, athletically speaking, you held your own. I mean, bottom line is I will say during that day, there weren't too many basketball players that are going to beat me. I mean, it just wasn't. I mean, I was decent.
Yeah.
Okay, I was decent. But I still didn't I did not get the playing time that I would have gotten had I stayed at Dunbar High School.
And that's why you regret taking the choice here.
In part, yes, because it was, in part, because I ended up playing college ball for a year as a walk-on at what's called University of Central Florida now.
Mm-hmm.
But I really should have been recruited to play ball at a lot of other schools because I didn't get the exposure.
Yeah.
And I can honestly say, and the reason I say that is because my senior year at Fort Myers, we went undefeated.
Mm-hmm.
We were rated 9 and 10 in the state. And the word was that when we played Boca Ciega in the district finals in our own gym, the word was, do not play the black kids. And
really?
We lost. Yeah, and we lost. I mean, you can confirm. That's the word.
Okay, so that's just like...
Nobody will probably admit to that, but that's one of the reasons we lost. Because we were slated that year to go at least to the regional finals.
Mm-hmm.
Because 7 of our players played college ball off of that team. And we were, I mean, there was no team around here that could touch us because we had speed, we had a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But that night in our own gymnasium with 3 blacks who were an integral part of that whole team not getting any playing time. And we were losing in our own gym. Okay. I think, and we were seniors.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you know, I spent time in academia. I was a golf coach. And you know, the people say, well, why do the seniors get to play? Well, maybe because they paid their dues.
Mm.
I mean, if you play for me for 2 or 3 years and it's your senior year, you're going to get some time.
Yeah.
Simple. Even if you're sorry, you're still going to get some time because people reward folks for putting some time in and being dependable to them. But that particular night, us seniors, we were on the short end of that.
Yeah.
And I always regret that. I said, you know, this is interesting. But then again, I think about it, I didn't get much bigger. I played 1 year college ball. I figured, hey, these guys they're putting on me, they're huge, you know.
Yeah.
They put a guy on me 6'4", 6'5". I'm 6 feet. Yeah, I could jump out of the gym, but I only weigh about 145 pounds.
Mm.
No. It don't work.
Yeah.
Okay. It just doesn't work. Somebody could get hurt. But that's my recollection. And going to the white school that year, there were a number of fights. I mean, you could pretty much predict a fight.
Yeah.
If it was time to have a short vacation, somebody going to have a fight.
Mm.
You know? And the athletes, I remember that year, what would happen is the coaches would gather all the athletes and put them in the gym.
Yeah.
While the rest of the folks battled. And I often thought, why did they do that? Well, probably because we probably would have hurt somebody. Because, you know, you're in the top physical shape. I mean, you know, physicals, no, you might not be a boxer, but the bottom line is I run 2-3 miles every other day.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, if you make me mad enough, you could get hurt. But at Fort Myers, that year, we also had another pivotal event during Black History Week.
Mm.
We had a play because there was a black teacher by the name of Mrs. Brown, who's now deceased, Mildred Brown, who's now deceased, that had us do a Black History play. I can't even recall what the theme was, but at Cypress Lake and North Fort Myers, those principals forbid them from having a play.
Oh, really?
And black students walked out.
Yeah, okay.
And they came to Fort Myers.
Mm.
And when we're doing the play, we're looking out there saying, where do black people come from? Shoot. They came from the other schools to watch the play. And that was sort of a protest that we were a part of during that period of time. And, you know, it was kind of, I've never delved into it very deeply, but I will say that there is a certain naivete on the part of black school board members as well as white faculty about black concerns, you know, minority concerns. And they just felt, look, if we tell y'all to do it, you're going to do it. I'm like, that really, there's a certain amount of naivete with that and just writing off a total community as if it doesn't count. And to me, that was a slap in the face of the black community at that time. And it's a wonder there weren't even more racial eruptions of violence at that time. Because really all around the country, when you start talking about the '60s, every place was going through that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the school systems not handling integration in a proper and timely manner contributed to that. Because I think once kids got exposed to each other, they began to recognize that, you know, we're in the same boat.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad think I'm stupid too, so hey, you know, you know, say, you know, what's the deal? They provide me room and board, they tell me what to do. I mean, bottom line is, my dad do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and we're in school, the teachers treat you the same way. You don't know anything when you come to them. You do these kinds of things. We hopefully, you know, you know a little more when you leave me than when you're here. And it's all about following instruction and order and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think when you had the kids got along quite well, you always got that percentage of folks who've been brainwashed by their parents that, look, just call Johnny dark, Johnny stupid. They start finding out, no, Johnny might be dark, but Johnny ain't necessarily stupid.
Yeah.
Johnny not necessarily scared either, you know? And quite frankly, me and Johnny, we probably share a whole lot more than me and this older guy, this older person who's my parent sometimes, because we're in the same boat.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think if you look at the history, the fights began to diminish, in part because people became more familiar with each other in the school system. The school system became a little more receptive to bringing in professionals and allowing them to teach as opposed to warehouse kids. Because I'm sure you had your share of white teachers there that were afraid of blacks for no apparent reason. And it was a feeling out time, in my opinion. And I just happened to come along in it. I mean, I had a taste of the freedom of choice. I had a big taste of the forced integration. And then I was out of there.
Yeah.
I mean, I was out of there. I went to college. I tried to play ball at University of Central Florida. Figured that wasn't going to work out. Went to Edison, finished in a year, went to Dillard University, where I should have went the first time, on an academic scholarship, which is a predominantly black school, had a wonderful college experience, ended up getting married, ended up working professionally for the last 30-something years and retiring. So, hey, I mean, I went to University of South Florida and picked up a master's degree later on. After I was in the working world, because I began to realize that, you know, even though you may be proficient in things, at some point credentialing plays a factor on your upward mobility.
Yeah.
And so that's why I went ahead and got the master's degree. So I had a good time.
Actually, there's one thing I want to ask about before I move on to asking you about, like, college stuff. And I think this is after you graduated. I think it was probably like 1971 or something like that.
Okay.
But I heard that at one point during one of the fights at Fort Myers High School that they brought in dogs to use.
I heard that too. I was not there.
Yeah.
I was away, but I heard they brought in dogs and the kids ended up going to Friendship Baptist Church.
Okay.
And talking about that incident. Now, I'm not... they very well could have brought in dogs at that time to get some order.
Yeah.
Because really, the year after I left, I mean, things get worse before they get better. They got worse.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't there. My sister was there. But she never really talked about that because my sister, keep in mind, was a genius. Mm-hmm. She graduated a year early.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She took the NMSQT test, National Merit Scholarship test, scored so high that she had a boatload of college offers.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Very much so. She ended up going to Dillard, but she could have gone to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, any of them.
Wow.
I mean, she had a boatload of them. And she ended up, I ended up graduating a year before she did. She didn't catch me. She didn't catch me, but she almost caught me. She almost caught me.
Was that a joke in the family?
But no, actually, you know, I never really gave it any real thought till after I got out.
I said,
you know, my sister almost got out of college before I did, and she was 2 years behind me. But we had a wonderful time. Mm. But she graduated in 71. She was supposed to graduate in 72.
Okay.
But she scored so remarkably high on that test, it was like, you know, you go on to college, we're going to give you a diploma. Mm. And that's what they did.
Does she also still live around here?
She lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Ah, okay.
Matter of fact, she just recently retired from Olin Chemical Company after 40 years service.
Oh, wow. So she was like a chemist?
She was a, what they call a quality control engineer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so she started out as a lab technician analyst out of college and worked her way up the corporate level, and you know, she had a 40-year service, and the company is getting ready to move to Houston, Texas, out of Chattanooga, and they gave her what I call a dream buyout. I mean, she don't have to worry about no money.
Yeah, good for her.
She done good.
All right. So now I want to ask about going to Dillard then, because Dillard, you said it was one of the, it's one of the HBCUs up there?
Correct.
Okay. Or, well, yeah, no, I guess it's up there still. Yeah,
it's
I usually was up there for like North, but
it's
like
in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's still up there. So after you graduated then from college, did you decide, or because you said you worked in the public sector in Louisiana afterwards, did you decide to stay up there because of just convenience, or did you have any thoughts about coming back to Fort Myers?
So I got married. My first wife is from New Orleans, and she was a year behind me, so I stayed in New Orleans a year after I graduated. I worked for a company called Redball Motor Freight.
Okay.
As a line dispatcher. A 24-hour line dispatcher. Then we had an economic downturn. We went from a 3-dispatch team to a 2-dispatch team. Mm. I worked a 12-hour shift, and another Hispanic guy worked a 12-hour shift because it was a 24-hour operation. That wasn't the killer.
Yeah.
The killer was all members of management at some point in time were required to do a Saturday.
Okay.
So I remember going to work on a Friday at 6 o'clock, and I didn't get off till Saturday at 6 o'clock.
Jesus.
That's right. And I missed my first wife's, I think, commencement because I laid down and they said I woke up a day later.
Oh, wow.
Because, it was when you worked in the private sector, the bottom line was, hey, you make money for the company.
Yeah.
And as a dispatcher, we had 24-hour dispatch. We had to work with Teamster drivers. We had to work with people, the suppliers. So, you know, the bottom line is you had to do what it had to do. Mm-hmm. It had to do to make it happen. Now, during that time is when they first started coming out with this key punch type operation where they would communicate between machines and stuff. And I can recall one night sitting there, and a guy walks in and wants to get his papers to take the truck back. And I'm like, you really not on my schedule. And the reason it was important is because if you're a Teamster driver and you don't have an assignment within a certain time, they got to pay you 8 hours.
Mm.
Now, who get blamed for that?
Yeah.
Me. The guy shows up, he's there a couple minutes, then all of a sudden the dispatch machine comes out. 2 hours ago, we sent somebody to you. Find him and empty to send him back. And I'm like, really? So, I did what you're supposed to do. I got him something, got him on his way. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize till later on, you know, somebody screwed up and sent from dispatch. And they dumped it on me.
Yeah.
You know? Because all I knew was there was this mythical place called Central Dispatch in Dallas, Texas, mm-hmm. that controlled the system.
Yeah.
I had gave no thought to the fact that, you know, there's some people over there just like you, you know, that doing the best they can with what they got. Sometimes they make mistakes.
Yeah.
And but I did that for a year. And then my wife graduated. We moved to Shreveport, Louisiana, because she got a teaching job there. She was a special education teacher. And in Shreveport, I worked as a insurance guy doing a debit and selling insurance. Now this was strange because the first policy I sold, it was like this lady had like 5 children. And I'm like, I'm selling her a death policy, and I'm like, man.
Oh,
I guess. You know, I'm thinking to myself, you gotta make money.
Yeah. So,
hey, she wanted, but I did that for maybe about 6 months, and then the state. Had this civil service system, and I was hired as a support enforcement officer for the state of Louisiana,
okay.
supervising child support offenders.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically what happened was the feds decided to move away from this notion of counseling people back together. They said, look, we got too many absent parents on welfare.
Yeah.
They're paying for their children. Where are these absent parents?
Mm-hmm.
So they went to a system where, okay, if you're getting a welfare check, whomever is the father of these children need to pay their money to us.
Yeah.
You know, get them under a court order. And the state's responsible for making sure that that's collected. So we work with the courts and the Office of Family Services. And the idea was putting these people under child support orders and collecting the money.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for about 2.5 years and got promoted to senior officer. And be honest with you, I just got tired of cold weather. In Shreveport, to me, the first time I was there, it snowed for about 3 or 4 days. And I got caught out in that snow with an empty car looking at dew crystallized on a country road. And I said, man, this is kind of wild. Second year, it snowed 2 weeks. And I had bought a brand new car, and I remember going up a hill, and somebody stopped at the top. So everything behind them slid right back down the hill.
Oh.
I'm in a brand new little Chevette, and I mean, it's like slow motion. My car, I had no control whatsoever. And then it was just cold. I mean, for a Florida person, it was just cold.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in the summertime, it'd go the exact opposite. We had a week there where 3 of the 7 days, it was 100 plus.
Ooh, wow.
And see, where Shreveport is, you basically have the Red River, which means if it's hot in the day, it's hot at night.
Yeah.
So I just made a conscious decision. I said, man, I need to go home. I remember one night I was driving home. It was raining. It must have been 20-something degrees outdoors with the rain. And I said, I ain't got no business up here. I need to leave. I told my boss, I said, look, love my job, got promotion. I know you can send me anywhere I want to go, but the bottom line is I'm going home. I'm a Florida boy. I'm not a Northwest Louisiana boy. I'm not a New Orleans, I'm not a Louisiana boy, I'm going home. And we picked the family up and we moved back here in 78. And then I went to work for the State Florida Department of Corrections, supervising felons. Did that for a little over 2.5 years. And decided I didn't want to do that anymore because, you know, I wasn't a criminology major.
Yeah.
I mean, after a while you start saying, man, these dudes have different problems than I. You look at people jaded, really, when you work with that.
Yeah.
And I work with felons.
Mm.
I mean, I worked with the county you read about in the newspaper, and they make the news with what the stuff they do. So the city of Fort Myers decided they wanted to do an affirmative action program. And I competed for that position, got it, developed an affirmative action program for the city, doing some training stuff, EEO and that kind of thing, with the city hiring authorities. Then the county recruited me to handle their community relations office, and then I built an office with the county, the Office of Equal Opportunity. And then they went through several county administrators, and the last one I was under, the guy was intimidated by me. I hate to say it, I don't know why. I guess every conversation he would run into, my name might come up. But what he didn't realize, I've been there for 12, 13 years. I mean, come on. Most of these people here, I was here before they got here.
Yeah.
I was here after they left here.
Mm.
And, the nature of my office got me involved in just about everything the county did.
Yeah.
Because from employment to contracting, to fair housing issues, to fair employment. I mean, I was involved in it. So, make a long story short, we kind of had a meeting of the minds, and I said, well, it's time for me to go. I'm not going to fight it too much. I did take them to court. I did win a judgment, which was reversed by a judge that died.
Oh, okay.
And which meant that on appeal, obviously I didn't get anything, didn't get any love on appeal.
Yeah.
So then I went into teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. McNerney, principal of Mariner High School, Bobby D'Alessandro was superintendent then. She came to me and asked me if I wanted to teach. And I said, Bobby, like I told you before, I did not go to school to teach. I've been working with adults most of my life. You'll turn me loose with them kid? No, I said, Bobby, no, I don't think we're gonna, it ain't gonna work. It's just not gonna work. So after a while, I couldn't find anything in the state bureaucracy, and I said, well, I'll go into teaching. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, I couldn't understand the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Because I kept looking at the schedule the guy was showing me, talking about this. And I said, well, when do I eat? And I said, well, you get 25 minutes for lunch with your kid. I said, well, now keep in mind, I'm used to having an hour for lunch.
Yeah.
And, I'm an administrator. I work as long as you want to, but don't, I'm not on a time clock. But I enjoyed it. I spent 4 years, I think, at Mariner. Then I spent 2 years at Bonita Middle. I did sixth and eighth grade there. And then I spent my last 16 or 17 years at Dunbar High School.
Okay.
So, I looked at it. I had a good teaching career.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted me to become a principal. I said, nah, I said, like, been there, done that. Just let me teach my classes. And I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I really did. I really enjoyed it. But I put in, I figured after 35 years, that was enough. I mean, because after a while, you kind of like, been there, done that. And then in teaching, they start coming up with all these using the technology and the smart board and
yeah,
this and that. And I'm like, every time it looked like I was learning a new program, I said, no, I'm time to go. I mean, it's time for me to go. I mean, I'm technologically sufficient to the point that I want to be and just get by, but as far as loving it, no.
Yeah.
Because I even noticed it with the internet. You get used to seeing a certain thing, and all of a sudden it changes. You're like, okay, now how do I do this?
Yeah.
And I said, let me go with my gold shield. And I've been in retirement now since 2014. Mm. And very much involved with my church. We're getting ready to build a multi-million dollar church in the community here. I'm an avid golfer, because I was a golf coach at Dunbar for 12 years. I started a golf program. I left the golf program. And next week, I set up a not-for-profit foundation in my father's name, because he died about 12 years ago. And we give a scholarship to a graduating senior from a local high school each year. And we do a golf tournament as our primary fundraiser doing that. So we've done that for the last 11 years. And next year, Father's Day weekend, we'll have another one.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's sort of my busy time, really.
Yeah.
I mean, next week, we couldn't have met.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'd be saying, man, do I have all the players? Do I have the signs? Do I have this and that? And we have a good time. I have about 35 or 40 people that come out. They have a good time. We raise a little money. We're awarding a scholarship to a young lady graduating from Cypress this year that's mm-hmm. going to University of Florida, by the way.
Oh, hey.
That's right. She's going to study business administration. She's got like a 4.6 GPA.
Yeah.
great person. Mm-hmm. Great person. And my attitude is that if we invest in our young people, young when they need it, when they get older, they'll come back to the community and make some contributions here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often thought of that.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're even though like you've left like even yeah. the school and the county and stuff like that, you're still
I'm still active. I hate to. Sometimes I'm wondering. I'm like, man, what is this stuff here? But it's it gets hectic sometimes. But I imposed an artificial schedule, really, because I usually on Friday 12 o'clock. If it ain't gonna get done, I ain't doing it. So I'm through. Unless it's an emergency.
Mm.
So I'll go from Monday to Friday at 12. That's cool. But after 12, I want to go golf. I want to look at TV. I just want to chill out.
All right. So I want to ask some questions then about what you were telling me about, like, all your employment and things like that. And I guess I'll start with when you were a teacher, because you were moving around schools and then you stayed at Dunbar for an extended period of time. Did you, because I know Dunbar opened in the early 2000s. Did you start at Dunbar the year that they reopened it?
The second year.
Okay.
2001, I think I went to, because they opened it, I think they reopened Dunbar in 2000, and I came the second year. And they only had freshman and sophomore classes when I came, because each year they would add an additional class. So I think their first graduating class wasn't until like 2004, 2005. So each year, basically what would happen, I taught world history, I believe, when I went there, and then I taught U.S. history. And then I taught economics.
Mm.
And I taught economics. Anybody graduated from Dunbar through 2014 had my class. I put my imprint. You mentioned Mr. Well, they will know who you're talking about.
All right.
Because as a senior, and I know how the seniors work, government is a piece of cake.
Yeah.
Economics, not a piece of cake. No, because you got to do a little math, you got to do a little this. And the objective really is to let you know that, look, yeah, life can be fun, but then there are some fundamentals that you need to take care of if you're going to be self-sufficient.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I've had countless students come back and say, tell me, Mr. Well, we only scratched the surface, but all that stuff you were telling us is true.
Yeah.
You know, it's true. They expect you to work to get something. And if you don't work, then they won't call you back.
Mm.
And they won't be mad with you either. Because there's about five other people out there ready to do what you're doing. And I said, well, that's good. I'm proud to say the vast majority of kids that I had are doing something.
Yeah.
They either went to college, working, because I run into them from time to time. They got kids, they got families, they're making a contribution to the community. So I really saw my role as a teacher as to communicate that to seniors. which I preferred because, I mean, I'll be honest with you, the 2 years I spent in middle school, I almost had a nervous breakdown, really, because, I mean, it's, I went from teaching 12th grade to 6th grade.
Yeah.
And I remember in 6th grade, teaching the kids, we're going to have snack time. I said, what? I said, I caught myself. I said, no, you, this is a elementary school kid. And the parents used to say, well, you know, he used to teach in high school. So, you know, the press will say, well, we're in the character teaching here. And I'm thinking, I thought about the Charles Barkley thing. I'm not your role model. But then I said, well, I only had 2 years in middle school. And the first chance I got, I went back to high school because I said, this ain't going to work.
Yeah.
Because I taught 6th grade, and then I taught 8th grade. Now, 8th graders were okay because they really wanted – They were ready to go to the next.
Yeah, they're like on the line.
They're ready to roll. But I'm gonna tell you, 9th graders, they're out to lunch in high school. Oh gosh, man! When I went back to high school, I had this 9th grade class, and I'm like, I knew you in 8th grade. You weren't like this, man. And I think what it is like the lights. All of a sudden, they're in a population. They're the smallest people on campus.
Yeah.
And they see all these big folks around, and they really don't know where they fit in.
Mm-hmm.
So what ends up happening is sometimes if the middle school hasn't prepared them to really read and study, they do not know what earning a credit means till they have to go to summer school.
Yeah.
And somebody, a kid got counselor, is sitting around talking about, now, okay, next year, here's your goal. Now, this year, you were supposed to get 6 credits. You only got 4. Now, next year, in order for you not to be super behind, you're going to have to make up them 2 and make sure you get 6 more.
Mm.
Now, you need to think about how you lost 2. And that behavior, if you can control it, you need to avoid that one.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you're going to be in school with your friends, little brothers and sisters, trying to explain why your friend graduated and you're not graduating.
Mm-hmm.
And recognize that high school teachers are a little different from middle school teachers. They really don't. You know, if they don't like you, they're not paid to like you. They are paid to give you instruction and treat you fairly.
Yeah.
Now, anything beyond that, I mean, it ain't happening.
Mm.
And see, a lot of your freshmen, after that first year, the lights go off, and then they begin to realize, look, if my plan is to get a high school diploma, this is what I got to do. I enjoy seniors because they have already made a decision. I'm either going to the military, I'm going to college, or I'm going to work, but no matter which one I go to, they're going to ask, did I get my high school diploma?
Yeah.
So my attitude was, we good, we can work with that, because I know that if you go in the work world and you can't add, you can't read, that's not going to reflect well on me, and it's definitely not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah,
because I had countless attorneys tell me, "But well, you teach economics, teach them how to balance a checkbook." I said, I will do it, because they came up with a program, Junior Achievement, which they institutionalized. I don't know where this fly comes from.
I know
institutionalized. Where you had to do some applied economics on the computer and do some, and because I was able to balance it out. Because oftentimes what I grappled with in high school was, how could I give a child a balance between the practical application of economics and the theoretical? And if they found themselves in a college course, they aren't totally lost.
Yeah.
Because in college, they usually teach you macro one semester and micro one semester.
Yep.
And oftentimes, if you haven't had any, that's like Greek.
Yeah.
It really is.
Oh, trust me, I know. I was at an econ major before I switched over to history, so I know.
You know. And,
yeah.
And a lot of times it's like, man, especially when they get into applied and all this, it's kind of like, whoa, what? this ain't real world, is it? I mean, this is, you talking about X, Y, and I, what the heck? So what I would do is I would purpose for my honors classes, I would do some micro basic principles, and near the end I might sprinkle in a little bit of macro.
Yeah.
Not much, because you know macro is, hey, for college students macro is crazy. I took it in college. I'm like, I have no idea how I passed some of that first. Because I was in a class with like 500, and you know, the dude was from Arabia somewhere. He wasn't even American, you know. And sometimes he'd get excited and be, you don't know what the heck he's talking about, you know. I went by his office one time. I said, no, you can't explain this to me. I got to go get a tutorial or something. But I was able to pass the course. But I realized it can get pretty intense.
Yeah.
And so I tried to do that with the high school students. Just give them a taste so that they know when they go into college, you're going to cover the book, not just a couple of chapters. And that's what really, I think, blows a lot of people's mind when they go to college. They're used to covering a few chapters. Guy gave you 3 or 4 books, he's making you read them all.
Yeah.
Right. And in history,
oh, boy.
I know you do that. Yeah, I mean, and in grad school,
that's like a book a week.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's, but it's like anything else, though. If you do it enough, it comes easier to you.
Mm.
And, you know, after a while, hey, it's just, you know, okay, I saw this one before. This is just a reiteration of that. Okay, I know where we're coming from. I'm speaking the language, so to speak.
Yeah.
But you got to practice it. You can't just pick it up and put it down. And then econ is one of those subjects. You just can't pick it up and put it down.
Mm.
You either in it or you're not. It's like taking algebra. You either in it or you're not.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and a lot of teachers that did like I did, transition from one area to come into teaching, what hangs them up really is the logic, the math in logic, mainly because it wasn't taught.
Mm.
I mean, when I went to school, yeah, I got through college algebra stuff, they didn't teach me no logic.
Yeah.
I had to take a refresher course to get my teacher's license in logic. Once I took that, because keep in mind, I had already passed STAT, research methods and STAT, but logic is a little different. It's another language.
Yeah.
And if you know the language, you can speak it. But if you haven't seen the language or nobody's exposed you to it, you're up the creek.
Mm.
So, but no, I had a good time. Teaching really became a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, the first couple years of teaching, I was wondering, you guys really don't pay enough for people to do all this.
Mm.
'Cause teachers, folks don't understand. You got to put together a lesson plan. You got to put together some kind of exercise that a typical person, conscientious person can do and hopefully gain something. Then you have to evaluate them from time to time. And you can't, one thing about college though, you don't have to evaluate them as regular. In high school, I have a test. If we finish the chapter, we're going to have a test.
Yeah.
I taught a college course. We had a paper, we have one midterm and one final.
Mm.
Excuse me, somebody calling me here, interrupting us.
Oh, that's fine. If you need to take it, I can stop it and start.
Let me take
it. Well, we'll make good use of these 15 minutes then.
Okay.
All right, so I've got 2 more questions.
Sure.
Then. Last thing I want to ask about with you teaching and being at Dunbar, I want to know what was like the talk in the community at the time when they were talking about reopening Dunbar. Like, why did they decide to reopen it?
Well, I think there was a push on the part of the NAACP at that time that with the growing student population and the facility being where it was, it made no sense not to use it. And when they reopened it, it was kind of, in my opinion, an appeasement, because when I went back the second year, we were teaching in the same structure that I had in the 60s.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
That's
it was, I mean, it's functional, but hey, come on.
Yeah.
I had taught at some other high schools at Marin. I'm like, it was no comparison, okay? And what happened over the time I was there, it became more and more apparent that the structure had to be changed, because I had an experience in my classroom, I think about 2 or 3 years before I retired. A kid kept telling me, said, well, there's a black spot coming up in the floor. And I'm like, really? Just wipe it up, you know? Wipe it up, come back.
Yeah.
Wipe it up and come back. Come to find out, it was a pipe from the science wing that had percolated up through the soil, through the cement, into the structure.
Oh, wow.
Right. And the way the district discovered that, I was displaced out of my room for practically a year while they dug a 4 by 6 foot hole through the concrete to the pipe.
Yeah.
And after that, I think somebody said, you know, we just need to tear this building down and rebuild like we should have when we opened in 2001.
Yep.
Okay? Because the population was growing.
Yeah.
The programs there are excellent. Mm. I mean, they've done a real great, they have an IB program there for engineering students.
Oh, okay.
You know, IB is usually the college-bound social type curriculum. Now their IB program is designed for people going into engineering school and math and stuff. So you can actually finish there and make a decent living.
Yeah.
I mean, Microsoft certification, the whole bit.
Yeah.
So, but they should have done that before they opened it.
Okay. So when they reopened, they, because I know about them having built like the entirely new Dunbar School now. When they reopened, they just threw you guys in the school that just opened in the 60s.
Pretty much. That's what it was. And they, because I taught on the freshman wing, and I remember the first year, it was always under construction.
Yeah.
Okay. There's that light at the end of the thing. You'd have to walk towards the light to go to my wing. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, rather than piecemealing this construction stuff, the prudent thing would be to raise this whole building. Decide if you want to keep a historical piece, because they had an octagon-shaped band room, which I thought they should have kept.
Mm.
It was because I played in a band when I was coming up.
Yeah.
And I remember learning to play instruments in that room. And they used it as the equipment room for the sports supplies, because I had a heck of a golf equipment room. Oh gosh, man, I must have had 2,000 clubs in there.
Oh wow,
people would donate stuff, and I threw away a bunch of stuff. I mean, some of the stuff they donated was trash, but I kept a lot of stuff. I used to tell the AD there, I said, look, you realize you got one of the best equipped facilities here. And it was hard to get golfers.
Yeah.
People go to Dunbar, most of them want to play basketball and football. But the building should have been raised when they reopened it. But they didn't.
Yeah.
It was an appeasement. We made it work. When I say we, I mean the faculty that was there. I mean the kids. We did what any other school had. Carl Burnside was very good with picking talent to come into that school that could relate to the types of kids that went to that school.
Yeah,
and that's why they get all kind of awards and stuff. Mm. You know, and their athletic program is by none. I mean, you know the Dunbar Tigers.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You see the orange and green, you know. When we used to play teams and stuff, my kids had on them bright orange shirts. And I said, well, it wasn't many of them, but you knew it was out there.
I remember when I was interviewing George Mayo, he had on a Dunbar High School shirt with the Tiger. And he's like, you know what that is? I'm like, oh, you know damn well I know what that is.
Exactly right. And it was in the school, what I find with the young people, The school that Cutler's father was Florida A&M University. A lot of them think it's University of Miami. I said, no, you got to go back a little further. Because they used to call the Dunbar Band the Little March of 100 after Florida A&M Band. And a lot of the kids. One thing I enjoyed being there, I would share some of my perspective of history from what I remember. And they say, oh, that's us. Yeah, back in the day, that's what they meant. Now, they don't mean some of this stuff y'all attached to it. That's what they meant back in the day. What else you got there, Hoss?
Well, I wanted to ask, when you were doing the county, or when you were working with the county and stuff like that, from like the 70s up until you became a teacher.
Right.
I wanted to ask, because, I mean, we don't really talk about like the late 70s or like present day. It's kind of like at the cusp of where we talk about history and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What were some of the problems that were prevalent in the community when you were working?
Okay, when I came back as a felony probation and parole officer, we didn't have many black felony probation parole officers, but we had a lot of black probationers and parolees. Mm. And in the court system, you didn't have a lot of blacks involved in the court system. Because back then, I think Judge Isaac Anderson was like the first county judge.
Yep.
And then he was the first circuit judge. And he and I used to be joking. I said, man, I'm the tall, skinny one down here, and you the short, fat one. Because we were the only two black folks worked that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was over in court administration. I was in the county administration building when I was an administrator.
Oh, wow, okay.
Because, see, when I ran the Office of Equal Opportunity, I was the only black administrator down there. Mm. They didn't have any others.
Yeah.
You know. And I recall when I worked for the city, I had a parking space next to code enforcement. And I used to always wear a suit and a tie, coat, jacket, and stuff. And the guys... One guy told me, he said, man, guy, just sit there and watch you go walk to your car, take your jacket off and fold and just shake his head. I said, well, whatever. I said, look, hey, I'm working, man.
Yeah.
This is how I work. But we were pioneers.
Yeah.
Because I remember sitting in the mayor's office looking out over the Clues Hatch and see, you know, ain't too many black people up here doing this. Mm. And but I embraced it, though, because being the oldest in my family, being a second-generation college graduate, hey, you know, I'm just doing what I've been trained to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't ask anybody to do me no favors. You know, I did my job. Mm. And when I went into academia, many blacks had made many more strides there because they had black principals and this kind of stuff in academia, but when I worked at Bonita Middle, there wasn't but, I think, two black males in middle schools in South Fort Myers.
I think you're actually right with that, because I remember looking at a news press article where it was, I don't remember when it was printed, but it was in the desegregation folder that they have over in the museum, in the office. And I remember, I think you're right, it was Bonita Springs. I saw there were two black kids, and I was thinking to myself, I'm like, imagine being one of those two kids in an entire school where there's no one else like you.
Right.
And or that can relate to you, too.
True, because when I taught there, they did, News Press did a story, and I was the only black male middle school teacher down there in all the middle schools. And see, Bonita Middle is a strange school, number one. First of all, it's international. In other words, they got more Hispanics at Bonita Middle, well, when I was there.
Yeah.
I mean, different types of, that's when I learned that, you know, in the Hispanic culture, there are different types.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, because, I mean, I had a kid come in and tell me, said, Mr. Webb, we'll see you in 2 months. I said, what do you mean, 2 months? I said, they finna go to Mexico. And sure enough, they came back 2 months. The first year I was there, I went to the graduation exercises. You would have thought they graduated from college. Mm. And I asked someone, I said, what? Don't they know they got at least 3-4 more years to do? They said, nah. I said, let me tell you, the males, they go to work.
Oh, okay.
Period. When they get eighth grade, they go to work.
Oh, wow.
They don't go to high school. They go to work. The females, if they're smart, they go to high school. Mm-hmm. If not, they go to work too.
Wow.
Yes.
And this was like in this late 90s?
This was like 90, before I went to Dunbar. This was like 99, 98.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 99, 98.
Is that even still legal now? I thought you were required to put your kids through high school.
16.
Wow.
You get 16, you go.
Yeah, 16, and you can be off on your own.
That's right. And see, some of those Hispanics did not start school on time, in part because of the work duties.
Yeah.
Okay, because, you know, when you start looking at the Hispanic community, an awful lot of their parents still follow that migrant work fair type thing, which means that there are big patches of time when the kids are not in any kind of school.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of times it's not unusual for them to be 15, 16 years old in middle school.
Hmm.
And that was a culture educational thing from then.
Yeah.
And then you got all these different languages, and I didn't speak fluent Spanish. I knew a little bit of Spanish, but I didn't speak fluent Spanish. But at Bonita Middle, that was like working in a foreign country.
Huh.
It really was. I mean, I did what I needed to do.
Yeah.
The bottom line is they have their own obstacles to education. And when you look at the parentage, they don't think about their kids going through high school to college. Mm-hmm. They think about their kids getting to the point to where they can read enough, write enough to interpret, and go to work.
Yeah.
Because they're oftentimes helping parents that have no fluency in English at mm-hmm. all. And, you know, once you get out of middle school, you're not super educated, but, you know, you can get by.
Yeah.
You can get by. And that's what happens. So they don't go home. Now, if you go to Estero, there's probably a much larger percentage of Hispanics that are matriculating there now, but that's been an evolving thing.
Mm.
See, since the 1990s, that's been evolving.
Yeah.
That ain't always been the case, you know. And so you find that, I found that interesting, the brief period of time I was down there. One of the other biggest reasons I moved from there is, you know, driving from East Fort Myers to Bonita Middle was at least a 30 to 45 minute drive.
Yeah.
And the price of gas went up to where it's prohibitive. You know, and I remember going, one time it took me an hour to get home because of an accident on I-75.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, man. It was wild. Because the principal hated to lose me down, but I said, look, y'all, I got to get closer to my house.
Yeah.
I probably could have stomached doing middle school the rest of my career, but that drive was killing me.
Oh, I imagine. I was going to ask about that, too, with, like, you staying at Dunbar, too, like, if it was just a matter of convenience.
It was a matter of convenience.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of looked at it like, look, I taught at the northernmost high school because Mariner at that time was the northernmost.
Mm.
I taught at the southernmost middle school, so now I'm right in the middle of the urban school. I'm good.
All right.
Okay, you look at my career, hey, I done it. I've been there.
All right. Well, I guess we're hitting 15 minutes right there on the thing, so we'll end it there. Thank you so much, Lovie.
All right, I enjoyed it.
With me.